Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the structural explanations were largely missing from most media accounts. So the deeper structural problems with the banking sector and issues around financialisation and how this affected the economy, these issues weren't really covered.
We talk about the misrepresentation of the financial crisis by the mainstream media. But first, here's a quick roundup of the Tax Justice News headlines. In edition 86 of the TaxCast last month, we joined the calls by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists for the European Commission's Competition Commissioner to start investigating at least one of the 246 secret tax deals exposed by the LuxLeaks whistleblowers, where Luxembourg's tax authorities gave multinational companies outrageously low tax rates. We argued that they urgently needed to do that if they wanted to avoid accusations of a conflict of interest from EU Commission President Juncker, who also happens to be former Prime Minister of Luxembourg and chief architect of Luxembourg's rapid acceleration of its tax haven model. Well, good news. Competition Commissioner Margarete Vestager is now investigating three tax deals Luxembourg gave to a Finnish packaging company, which she suspects amounted to illegal state aid. Here's Simon Bowers of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists.
Yes, this is great news. She's shown she's serious about LuxLeaks and she's opened an investigation. The use of state aid laws to challenge tax rulings for multinational companies is already a pretty innovative tool. And in fact, the successes they're having is precisely because this tool wasn't anticipated by the tax planners who invented these structures. She's really put a marker down on LuxLeaks. There was, she believes, illegal behaviour in these tax deals. And that's very significant for the last remaining LuxLeaks whistleblower in the courts, Raphael Allais, facing a challenge to his Article 10 rights to express himself freely in the European Court of Human Rights. If the European Commission is saying that the behaviour he helped expose is illegal, then his case is far more likely to succeed, one would think.
Good news. And talking of breaching EU competition laws, the Commission has fined monopolist and minimal taxpayer Google nearly €2 billion for illegal practices in search advertising. Basically, it's been abusing its dominant market position, denying consumers choice, innovative products and fair prices. This is the third time the Commission has fined Google for anti-competitive practices. And more good news this month from the EU Commission. It really has been a cracking month for the Competition Commissioner. She's saying a tax exemption granted by the Portuguese authorities to companies in the free zone of Madeira is, quote, unlawful aid that cannot be considered compatible with the internal market. These so-called free zones operate pretty much like temporary tax havens, and the Commission's seeking proof now that this zone is genuinely where companies are generating income and where they really do have significant numbers of employees based there. This is what they call a preliminary ruling, but its conclusions are unlikely to change at this point. It sets an important precedent for other such zones, of which there are many. And finally, US companies that aren't transparent on the taxes they pay are being targeted by a coalition of Christian investors who control assets of £21 billion. They're using their voting powers against the chairs of Russell 50 and FTSE 350 companies they're invested in, which score badly on tax transparency. Affected by that are companies including ExxonMobil, Amazon and Broadcom. And there's more good news coming up next. We're going to talk now to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. OK, John, we've got some really good news this month. There's been a very successful court case. The Tax Justice Network Africa challenged the Kenyan government over a double tax agreement it signed with the tax haven of Mauritius. And Kenya's High Court has now ruled in favour of tax justice on the basis that proper procedures weren't followed in bringing this agreement into force. it didn't really rule so much on the basis of Tax Justice Network Africa's very valid concerns that the treaty would harm Kenya's development by cutting taxes on interest, royalties and management fees, in some examples reducing those from 20% to zero. There have been similar agreements signed between Mauritius and other African countries which have really reduced the tax revenue available to poorer nations. So this is really good news, because this double tax agreement would have allowed companies which were established and doing all their actual business in Kenya, yet were legally registered in Mauritius, to avoid paying taxes in Kenya. They're doing that through a kind of a round-tripping process to get ridiculously low tax rates. Good news. First of all, tell us briefly, what is a double tax agreement?
Yes, double tax agreements, often called double tax avoidance agreements, are largely agreed bilaterally between one country and another, so they're not multilateral, they're normally bilateral. There are thousands of these agreements in place between countries across the world, and their primary intention is to avoid double taxation of profits of multinational companies. The idea being that if a multinational company is making profits in country A and it's being taxed in country A, it doesn't want to have the same profits taxed in country B, where the profits aren't being taxed. The trouble is that, by and large, the focus has been on avoiding double taxation of profits and not on avoiding double non-taxation of profits. So by and large, these agreements are there to protect the interests of the multinational companies and their investors, not the interests of the countries concerned. And more importantly, we've seen in so many cases in recent decades, double taxation agreements have also been used to push back against withholding taxes, which were often a very important protective mechanism. So a developing country could impose a withholding tax on profits, just in case it couldn't tackle the tax avoidance mechanisms being used by the multinational companies. So double taxation agreements have been lowering the tax rates, and in some cases actually removing them entirely. And also, in some cases, they've been removing capital gains taxes or lowering the rates on capital gains. So all in all, these double taxation agreements are, generally speaking, favourable to the interests of investors and not the countries. And for that reason, by and large, we think they're not a good thing and would advise countries against signing them.
Right, and this court ruling now, which says that this agreement between Kenya and Mauritius is unconstitutional, that could be interesting news for similar treaties that other countries have with tax havens like Mauritius. Just wondering what it could mean for them. India, for example, is going to help them possibly get out of a very bad similar agreement that it has with Mauritius, which it entered into 36 years ago.
Yes, I mean, the India-Mauritius tax treaty. Mauritius is, of course, a notorious tax haven and secrecy jurisdiction. It's been used by Indians for many decades now to shift profits and wealth offshore and then round-trip the capital back into India dressed up as foreign direct investment. It's a shockingly bad treaty, and they've been trying to renegotiate that treaty for a very long time. But in the case of African countries, Mauritius has been pushing very, very hard indeed. Many sub-Saharan Africa countries have already signed up double taxation agreements with Mauritius, and quite a number have already kind of agreed but not yet ratified similar agreements. Hopefully this ruling will signal to these countries, you must review what you're doing here. Now, the problem with the ruling is, as you said earlier, it's not really so much about the substance of the agreement as the process within which it was ratified, because it wasn't properly put through the Kenyan parliament, it hasn't been properly scrutinised, and that's the area where the court has ruled that it was void. So it's quite possible the Kenyan government will simply bring the proposal back to parliament, put it through a proper ratification and scrutiny process, and the agreement will be back in place. But what it does signal is that there must be a proper process of complete scrutiny by governments of these agreements. These agreements often give away far too much to the interests of companies that are using Mauritius as the base for their investment into Africa. I certainly hope that other countries will challenge the existing double taxation agreements, and not just with Mauritius, but also with other countries like the United Arab Emirates, Dubai in particular, Netherlands, and South Korea. And ideally, some of the existing agreements will be overturned by other African countries.
Okay, great work from Tax Justice Network Africa. Let's hope it holds. Last month on the TaxCast, we discussed the financialisation of aid and development assistance. And there's another very, very interesting court decision this month in the United States, where a Supreme Court majority decision has meant that the World Bank and other financial institutions can be sued. In other words, can be held legally accountable when their development projects hurt local communities. It seems pretty groundbreaking because they've always retained a certain level of immunity. This is based on the cases of two communities. There's one community of fishermen in India and farmers in Honduras whose livelihoods were destroyed and people's lives put in danger, some people killed. Now those communities, according to the court, can seek redress from the World Bank and other international lenders for the harm caused by those development projects. That's got huge implications because the International Consortium for Investigative Journalists estimates between 2004 and 2013, 3.4 million people were physically or economically displaced by World Bank financed development projects. So the way is now open for some very new possibilities.
Yes, and I think this is a very welcome first step. It's frankly very long overdue. Good news that the World Bank and other international financial institutions are open to legal challenge. Just by way of background, they were said that the World Bank was part of the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference settlement after World War II, and it was set up with the intention of promoting development and poverty alleviation. But time and again, over many decades, it's been clear that the World Bank's priorities have been to finance very large projects, big dams, huge power stations, mega infrastructure, and somehow they seem to have ignored the interests of marginalised people. And these marginalised people are frequently being displaced by these huge projects, either displaced because the dam simply floods the valleys where they live, or because the mega power station starts to totally disrupt their livelihoods in the places where they've lived. And that's precisely what's happened in the case of the fishing community in Gujarat, in India. Their livelihoods and their homes have been destroyed by the construction of a huge coal-fired power station, which is discharging hot and polluted water runoff into the Gulf where they fish and have fished for many, many years. And the World Bank appears to have ignored the fishing community's interests, maybe even weren't even aware the fishing communities were there in the first place. So when they assessed the loans to the power station operator, which is a very powerful Indian corporation, the Tata conglomerate, they appeared to have totally ignored the existence and the needs of this very marginalised fishing community.
Right. Both cases are going to return to US district courts soon for continuation, but it could take years for compensation to be paid out to these communities if the litigation is successful. In the meantime, I suppose it's way too much of a leap from that to be sizing up the possibilities for countries whose governments agreed in the past to, and currently, to outrageous and damaging structural adjustment programme conditions, which have hurt ordinary people and indebted nations to often no great purpose. Well, namely to follow a neoliberal economic development path.
Yes, the process of the current two cases that have been brought forward might take years to make their way through the district courts. But hopefully other communities which have been harmed by programmes funded by the World Bank or the IMF will start to bring their own actions forward and start challenging the World Bank. Now, challenging the wider issue of the kind of neoliberal Washington consensus which has been promoted by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, that's a much bigger and much more ambitious task. For years, the Washington consensus has been promoting programs of financial market liberalization, privatization of state-owned assets, tax cuts largely targeted at big investors and the very rich. And the results of this neoliberal program are clear for everyone to see. We've failed privatizations, the rise of largely unaccountable monopolies, public services starved of resources, rising inequality, huge environmental damage, huge social damage, the rise of radical right-wing extremism, all of these things can be, I think, rightly pinned on the Washington consensus. 40 years of neoliberalism has been a political and economic disaster. And for that reason, I think now is the time to start documenting and critically examining the role of the World Bank and the IMF over the last 40 years. And in many cases, they're still pursuing the same programs. Their tax consensus is still being forced upon many developing countries, despite the fact that we know it's failed. And I think this is a much longer term process, but it is a process that we must get underway.
Thanks, John. John Christensen for Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Looking back on the financial crisis in 2008 and all the consequences, new research shows how mainstream media reporting on it was misleading and was overloaded with supposed experts who turned out to be financiers and bankers. We know there's a huge gap to be filled here, and there are so many voices audiences didn't hear. And don't hear. That's why the TaxCast is so important. Because in many countries, the mainstream media fed us a diet of misunderstandings about economics and sold us the narrative that austerity was the only way to fix things. Alternative solutions and ways of thinking about the economy barely got a look in, and still don't. This month, we talked to Cardiff University's Mike Berry about his research and his new book, The Media, the Public and the Great Financial Crisis.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that in the press and in broadcasting, particularly for kind of the popular press, it was presented as a kind of morality tale. It was about bad bankers and their bonuses. And the structural explanations, these were largely missing from most media accounts. So the kind of deeper structural problems with the banking sector and issues around financialization and how this affected the structure of the economy, these issues weren't really covered. And when it came in particular to the bailouts, you got across the board in both press and broadcasting from the left and the right a strong perception that this was the only way you could actually deal with the problem, that we had to bail the financial system out and that there was no alternative. And certainly when we did audience research, it was very clear that these kind of narratives that you found across the press and broadcasting were very influential in terms of affecting how the public saw these issues. So when we did our focus groups, the public were very clear that they thought there was no alternative to bailing out the banks. They thought the nationalisation was probably a bad idea, but there hadn't been any choice. And this was very strongly reflected in the narratives that they found in the press. In a similar vein, when they actually came to understanding the crisis, they tended to take media narratives which, how shall I put it, meshed with their own personal experiences. So people themselves tended to see it as a crisis around bank bonuses and also about the overextension of credit because of the fact that they had experienced that in their own lives and the lives of their friends and family. So people would talk, you know, spontaneously about, you know, the creation of a plastic society, you know, the number of credit cards that they saw coming through their doors. So those particular kind of explanations that they saw in the press did mesh very much with their own personal experience.
Right, and it's interesting. I mean, I couldn't agree more that the media is very much about problems, crisis. It personalises. So with the big tax stories, we never get the structural problems about why Shakira, for example, could avoid so much tax as she did. It's all about Shakira, and we don't get at the systemic problems whatsoever. Mm-hmm. This is the big, big problem. When I started to make the TaxCast, I was filling a gap that the media just wasn't doing itself, the mainstream media, which was, how do we solve this? Mm. What are the real causes of these things? And they are structural, and maybe structural is boring. Well, that's what they think.
I absolutely agree in terms of the issue around solutions. And certainly when we looked at the reporting across the media in terms of how should we actually respond to the banking crisis, that most of kind of the reporting, particularly in kind of the popular press, was very focused around this issue around kind of bonuses and remuneration and the broader kind of systemic issues, which we might think of in terms of things like the fact that a lot of this very risky trading had taken place in tax havens, which were also used for kind of regulatory arbitrage. Those kind of issues were very peripheral. You got the odd article on that, but you know, that was missing. But you also got, and I think this is really important, is the way the finance sector is talked about. You get a very partial account in the media. When we looked at broadcasting, the BBC was dominated by the representatives of finance. They made up nearly half of the sources that were interviewed, and the other half were often people such as politicians who were very close to the finance sector. And so that's a key reason why you didn't get a lot of these very far-reaching systemic reforms, you know, talking about breaking up the banks, talking about separating the retail and the investment side of banking. I mean, you did get that later on, some of that, but you also had a lot of people on from finance telling us why those were very, very bad ideas. And you also get, particularly on the BBC, a relatively uncritical discussion of the role of finance within the broader economy. So finance is presented very much as the kind of the golden goose that lays the eggs, and we must be careful about, you know, not actually regulating finance too much because of the fact we may chase away the wealth creators, and it's a big part of the economy. And to a certain degree, some of that is true. But there is also another argument, a more critical view of the role of finance in the economy that's talked about in books like The Finance Curse, and interestingly also was talked about by the Bank of England in a report just after Big Bang, when they discussed in detail some of the potential negative consequences on the rest of the economy. For instance, the fact that the finance sector now sucks up a lot of the talent in society, which could be used in more productive parts of the economy. The fact that, you know, there are arguments that the finance sector is extractive, it acts as an extractive form of sucking wealth from other parts of the economy, and that favouring the interests of finance imposes costs on the productive economy, and that having a large finance sector, there is quite a lot of research to suggest that does actually have negative impacts on other parts of the economy. But that negative, you know, alternative perspective on the economy, we just didn't find in news reporting. And this is the crucial part. This had a big impact on how the public saw the contribution of the city and the finance sector more generally. When we were doing interviews, people would say, oh, the economy is very unbalanced, you know, outside of London and the South East, we're really struggling. We don't have manufacturing anymore. There's a decline in other kinds of industries. People would spontaneously raise the issue of the lack of manufacturing, how unbalanced the economy was, but they didn't relate that to the fact that we'd allowed a very, very dominant financial sector to grow up in London, which we know that less than 3% of its lending actually goes out to the productive economy, which produces goods and services. So these kinds of important issues were invisible to the public, primarily because they weren't talked about in the mainstream media, where most of the public actually gets its news and information.
Absolutely. It seems so slow for mainstream media to catch up with new thinking and new ideas and new research. I mean, even the IMF accepts that oversized finance is damaging to economies. And yet, it's still, even with a huge body like that supporting that kind of thesis, it's still not in people's consciousness.
Just, I mean, I think the key thing there to think about is, you know, in the UK, but also in a lot of developed countries, the US as well, and in the years leading up to the crash, I think it's important to realise that you had this groupthink that had become very, very dominant in policy circles, but it also became, because of the fact that most of the kind of key people in the media, the reporters and the editors, tend to mix in those circles, it became accepted by journalists, leading journalists as well. And that was that the finance sector was very important. It was kind of part of this new knowledge economy that we were going to build our economy around. And these kinds of ideas became accepted by a very, very wide range of people. And there were people warning about the dangers of finance, but those voices were seen, as one of the people I interviewed from the BBC, as lone wolves, and they were largely marginalised. And you had a kind of form of reporting that focused very much on aggregate indicators. You know, we had the nice decade, there was low inflation, there was growth, and everything was seen to be kind of bubbling along okay. But the deeper problems in the economy, the extraordinary degree of kind of regional economic polarisation that you found in places like the UK and the US, the decline in job security, those things were missed by the media. And those are issues particularly around kind of regional polarisation that are intimately connected to the rise of the finance sector. The journalists just didn't pick up on those things.
If we move to what happened as a result of the financial crisis, and let's talk about blame and how that was apportioned, you didn't really get that stronger sense that there was any alternative
to
austerity and, oh, well, we must all pay. This is an unavoidable situation and this is the only way forward. And there wasn't a lot of challenging about that in the mainstream media.
I think you're absolutely right. There's lots of questions that never really kind of rose to the surface. For instance, how should we regulate the derivatives market? You know, some of that has now been taken under public exchanges, but, you know, there's a lot of risky trading still going on. Those issues should have been probably dealt with and deserve much more scrutiny. And more broadly, you know, the whole question of what happened to these enormous financial institutions that were nationalised. They were then basically run by city grandees and run on a basically shareholder value model to extract as much money for the shareholder as possible and then privatise it as soon as possible. But, you know, there could have been other ways that, and there were people at the time arguing, though very much on the margins of coverage, you know, that we should think more seriously about actually doing banking a different way. And we could have actually nationalised, fully nationalised those industries and used them to direct lending to the productive economy. But that didn't happen. And that was definitely an opportunity that was missed.
We could have done quantitative easing in a much better way.
Absolutely.
Instead of giving it to the banks. We would have been better throwing it out of helicopters or just apportioning it among the population.
And amazingly, you know, there are very kind of conventional macroeconomists and people, you know, writing the Financial Times who say that now. So, I mean, these kind of particular views are not things that you see just on the radical left. You know, even kind of relatively middle-of-the-road, relatively conservative commentators have talked about, you know, the inadequacies of the response and the mistakes that we made then by not fully nationalising those institutions, and particularly, you know, the kind of approach for quantitative easing was, I think, a mistake. It's boosted asset prices, it's increased inequality. Probably there's some evidence perhaps that it did prevent, you know, a major slump, but at a pretty intense cost. To come on to that issue around austerity, I think what happened with the banking crisis, you had the slowdown caused by the banking crisis, and that led to a big fall in the issuance of credit. And what we know about the economy is in the years leading up to the crisis, the economy had become incredibly dependent on debt in order to drive growth. And you saw that go into reverse. So in aggregate, rather than people taking out new debt, you saw actually a restriction in the creation of new credit, but people continued to obviously pay off their historic debt. So that shrunk the money supply, and that led to a big recession. And the recession effectively led to a big fall in the tax base. So less economic activity, less tax, and that created a public deficit. Now, at the time, there was a debate within the macroeconomic community about how you would actually respond to that. When should you actually try to bring down the deficit? Obviously, it would fall naturally, cyclically, as you came out of recession. There was a question about timing, but there was also, crucially, a question of how you would do that. Should you put all the burden for adjustment onto cutting public services and forms of taxation that were relatively regressive, or should you focus taxation perhaps more at the people who are better able to pay? Now, what we found was, in terms of the reporting, was the reporting presented it in a very, very dramatic fashion. It was presented as a national emergency and something that had to be dealt with very, very quickly. So you got a very unbalanced picture of the dangers that were created by this build-up of the deficit and public debt. And together with this, you got arguments that, you know, the UK would see interest rate rises, that would be abandoned by international creditors, we wouldn't be able to sell our bonds, that the IMF would be called, that we might go bankrupt. I mean, these kind of discourses were very live at the time, and you found them across the press and across broadcasting, and they had a really big impact on public opinion. So they frightened people, and that helped to sell the idea that, you know, you needed to have austerity and that you needed to have cuts. Because when it came to the solutions, the only solutions that people were hearing about in the media was that essentially we had to cut the public sector. There was a lot of waste in the public sector, which is something that people believed, and we had to cut it. Alternative views, such as cutting in the middle of a recession was a very bad idea. Those were invisible, as were solutions which focused on tax rises on the better off, or, for instance, a financial transaction tax, or, you know, a land value tax, or an asset, wealth or wealth taxes. Or, you know, these sort of things are just completely invisible as public policy options. And when we did these focus groups for the public, they were completely unaware that there were these alternative options. And the media was really crucial in setting that debate in terms of both what was there and in terms of what was missing, the omissions.
Absolutely. And in a lot of economics reporting, you see time and time again in the mainstream that they use this kind of very emotive scarcity language, which who cannot relate to that? Who has not struggled financially in their lives? And then they relate that in such a simplistic way to the economy and how you should manage the economy. But it seems like common sense. Mm. And I think what's really interesting is that I can't remember who it was that said the success of neoliberalism has been its invisibility, you know, mm-hmm. and the fact that we're not seeing from the mainstream media that is actually a belief that they are representing. It's not fact. It's become such a dominant narrative that it is actually invisible. Mm. How do you counteract that, given that, as you said, a lot of people don't know about these alternatives because they have been absent?
Mm. I think you raised some really interesting points. And obviously the key to selling the kind of austerity narrative in Britain, one was the sense of danger that, you know, Britain could face bankruptcy and being abandoned by its international creditors, though the risks of that, you know, are almost non-existent. Countries that are sovereigns, that produce their own currency and have their own central bank, stable ones, long-term ones, like the UK, they effectively can't go bankrupt because they can always issue debt in their own currency and they can have the central bank buy it if needs be, or even monetize the debt. The real threat is inflation. It's almost impossible to see inflation as being a threat at that time because of the fact the economy was on its absolute knees in 2009-2010. But the key thing, that the selling of this notion that a national budget is like a household budget, that was an incredibly powerful metaphor. It was sold very heavily by politicians at the time. One of the crucial things is we just didn't find it being questioned. You didn't find journalists saying, well, hold on a minute, you know, a national government, its finances are nothing like a household economy because of the fact that, you know, it has its own central bank, it can issue its currency. When it spends money, a large proportion of that money comes back to it in terms of the way the fiscal multiplier works. Lots of myths were allowed to be propagated and they weren't challenged in the media, particularly this notion of that you can't spend money that you don't have, which you absolutely can as a government, and particularly when there's a recession on, you have to spend it because otherwise the consequences for the economy and people's livelihoods can be catastrophic. So I think the media needs to think harder about how it explains the economy, how economies work, how the multiplier works, what's the difference between debt and deficit, because these things are very poorly understood by people, as are the contours of public spending, where people will wildly overestimate how much the state spends on things that have a sustained negative media coverage. So things like migration or foreign aid. People massively overestimate the amount of money that's spent on those things because the media doesn't talk about the size of the public sector pie and there's no context for people to understand those issues. And that's a really crucial media failing.
I've been talking to Mike Berry of Cardiff University about his new book, The Media, the Public and the Great Financial Crisis. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.